Hello guys, thanks for letting me speak. I want to talk to you a few things about automated planning, which is basically the lectures are loosely based on the chapters, I believe 11, 12, 13 or whatever in the Structure and Knowledge. So I actually agreed to do these again because I assumed I already have slides. Except I changed them again. So the latest slides are again going to be up here. These were the old slides. And we'll see how far we go in the current version. Okay. One very important thing, if you actually download slides and try to print it, always print PowerPoint with the hidden slides off button, because I tend to put a whole bunch of things inside and only go through some of them in the class. And so, you know, you might think that a lot of things that were never discussed were in the slides. So only print non-hidden slides. Okay. So, you know, I mean, every topic, you're supposed to start by saying the whole point of your whole existence is that topic, and at least the whole point of this course is that topic. And most people try to make up something, but I think for automated planning it's easy, because after all, the whole point of doing intelligent agent design is to figure out for the agent to figure out what to do next. What do I do now? Okay. There's a movie by Spike Lee, which some of you are old enough to have seen, called, Do the Right Thing, okay, where this guy asks his father on the deathbed, so what do I do, and basically do the right thing. And so planning essentially is doing the right thing, given all the knowledge that you have, okay. So the right thing depends, of course, on, I mean, figuring out what's the right thing to do next depends on a whole bunch of other issues, some of which are not surprising at all to you. So for example, figuring out what to do next depends upon your goals. What is it that you want to achieve? Now you could have simple goals, where all the goals that you have, you must satisfy. Or you could have goals which are conflicting, and you're trying to figure out some subset of the goals that will maximize some utility. Okay. Oftentimes, we have conflicting goals. Have fun and do well in the courses. Very conflicting goals. And you partially satisfy both of them. Okay. This is Microsoft telling me to get along. Okay, so goals matter, and whether you have full goals versus partially satisfiable goals. The simple case is you have a bunch of goals and you must satisfy them all. Okay. The type of actions that you can do in the world matter. If the kind of actions you can do are deterministic, that means if you do the action, you know exactly what would happen to the world. Okay, you can predict exactly what would happen, and only one thing would happen. So if you are in a state S1, of the world, you would get to S5 of the world. Okay, that's deterministic. If it's not deterministic, then it's non-deterministic. Non-deterministic means you do this and something will happen. And we try, you know, a bunch of actions and see what happens as kids. And for adults, we basically say we'll do this and we think the following set of states can happen. That's non-determinism. So instead of once in this state, if I do this, anything can happen, which is the worst possible knowledge that you could have about an action, because you have no clue what would happen. To, if I do this action, either this will happen, or this will happen, or this will happen, which is hugely more knowledge than all possible things that can happen to the world. Okay? That's called non-determinism. Now, from non-determinism, you can get to stochastic. Again, by the way, some of this is sort of a repeat of the, I guess, lecture 2 or lecture 3, where you talked about environments and agent designs. I'm just redoing it to set the context. Stochastic is the case where you actually have some probabilities, some likelihoods of this will happen with 0.7 probability, this with 0.2, this with 0.1. Okay, so that's the stochastic. Now, if you can decide, if you can live in a world where you have deterministic actions versus you could live in a world where you have stochastic actions, which would you rather live in? I think it's reasonably obvious that most of us would choose to live in deterministic world, because we have some idea as to what would happen if you were to do this action. Okay. Now, there is also a secondary issue, such as whether the actions, when you do them, are they get done right away, or do they take for a long time to execute? Okay. So, a simple action such as start the war to put democracy in a particular country, and we started it, it's still going on. Okay, so that's a durative action. Instantaneous means you do it, it's done. And then right next to it is your new state of the world. It also depends upon the environment. If the environment, the simplest case for the environment is it's static, that means it doesn't change unless you do something to it. Dynamic means even when you, the agent, when I say you, this guy, okay? So even if this guy doesn't do anything, the environment will keep changing. Okay, dynamic worlds are harder because they don't give you too much time to think. You know, it's like standing in the middle of rural road and trying to figure out should I cross or not cross. Okay, observable versus partially observable. Standing in the middle of the road with your glasses having fallen down on the ground, and you really cannot tell what's going on the street. Okay. So that would be partially, at the best, partially observable world, and you know, versus you can see everything, it's completely observable. Clearly, you would like to live in a world where you can observe everything, and you'll also like to live in a world which is static, so it doesn't do anything unless you change the world. And then finally, the perception. So to some extent, these are connected. If the world is partially observable, even if you have the grade A glasses, you may still not be able to see everything. Okay, so even if you have high quality glasses, right behind this wall is something, you won't see it. Okay, most of us have 20/20 vision and still have blind spots when we are driving, because that has nothing to do with 20/20 vision. The world is partially observable. Okay, But then there are people who actually are driving, and they not only cannot see what's in their blind spot, they can also not see what's in front of them. You know, most of them are driving when you're driving on the road, right? And for these guys, they have, you know, probably bought cheap glasses. And so they have perception is the problem there. Okay? So in fact, it's nice to kind of differentiate these two. An environment could be, to some extent, the observability of the environment is a function of both the inherent observability of the environment and the kind of sensors that you were able to buy. Okay. So again, you would like to live in a world which is observable, where you have full, perfect sensing, and it's static, and the actions are instantaneous, and the actions are deterministic, and you have goals that must be satisfied, no ifs and buts. Okay. Too much choice makes life hard. Okay. If I said you must have fun and you must do well in the exam, that's somewhat simpler than, you know, try your best, because then you have to figure out what to do. In fact, you know, for my kid, it's exactly clear to me that we have to tell him, if there's a partially satisfiable set of goals, we have to tell him exactly the set of goals that he should satisfy. Those are the only ones he will. The rest will just fall out the stack. Okay. So, you know what are the easiest problems of this? So I guess I made two points with this slide. One is everything about AI is figuring out what action to do next. And the second is what action to do next is, of course, planning. And the difficulty of planning depends upon all these issues. Okay. So if you take static world, deterministic world, deterministic actions, completely observable environment, and instantaneous actions, then that's the cheapest, that's the simplest kind of planning that you could ever do, right? That was the thing that we were talking about. Okay, much of what we'll be discussing in this class is just this. Okay, it looks like a total letdown after having shown all those nice pictures, but we'll point out that this itself is darn hard, and so if you figure out how to do this, then you can, so basically, if I say I would like to do the simplest kind of planning, that's not, doesn't have the zinc to it. So you say it's a classical planning problem. So give it a name called classical planning. The classical planning, you know, in the old days people used to have easy life. So this is the planning that we'll talk about mostly. So now, having made these classical planning assumptions, you can start removing them one by one and see how bad the planning problem becomes harder. Okay? So one easy idea is to now say, well, the actions are no longer instantaneous, they are durative. If that's the case, you have something called temporal planning, which basically takes time into account. Okay? There's been work done on that. If the actions effects are not propositional, which means making something true versus false, as against making something true to a particular quantity. Okay, so for example, after this action, the water in the jug would be 3.7987 liters more than what it was before. Versus after this action, the jug will have water. One of them is propositional, other is a continuous effect. Okay, so handling continuous effects makes this problem somewhat harder. Now, if you take both these, are we still living in deterministic world? If you do either of these planning problems, are we still living in deterministic world? Yeah? I mean, I'm asking you to look at this problem. So I did not change anything about this part, so it's still deterministic world. And I did not change anything about this part, so it's still a static world. And it's still observable, but you can make it slightly more difficult by taking time into account, or taking continuous quantities into account. You can start throwing away static assumption and you will start having dynamic worlds, and you have things like adversarial planning, multi-agent planning. Okay. The only time in this course, did you guys do game playing? Outside of the class you did, but inside you didn't. So game playing, if you did it, chess and so on, that would have been the closest you would have come in intro to AI for multi-agent scenarios, where you know you do have an opponent. The part of the problem with chess that I keep trying to explain to my son that makes it hard is that there is an opponent. You know, without the opponent, if you can make both the moves yourself, you know, it's so much more fun. Get them faster. So the dynamic worlds, you have to talk about other agents and how to model them. Observability, you can remove the observability and you can start having partially observable worlds. Okay, and planning becomes harder. Now what happens when you have partially observable worlds is that you might need to first look at, I mean, based on your expectation as to what state of the world you are in, you might have to do a different type of action. Okay, there is work on this. We might discuss it if I come for a third class. And then, you know, there is the stochastic, and if you remove the deterministic, it becomes stochastic or non-deterministic. You can also try supporting planning algorithms for that. All of this, there is work on each of these in planning research. But mostly we'll talk about the lower part in this class. Okay? Now, notice, have I done everything by removing each assumption once at a time? What have I not done? I have kind of created myself with that picture a nice cottage industry that will keep me busy for a while, which is first remove one assumption at a time, then remove two assumptions at a time, then remove three assumptions at a time, and so on, right? So essentially, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 supposedly Boolean attributes, so I could have how many possible planning problems? What?
5 factorial.
5 factorial? What? Okay, good. So again, this is just, most of the time I ask a question, the answer would be 2 power, not 5 necessarily, but 2 power k. That would be the answer. You know, usually I say that if you're a computer science student and if you wake up with cold sweat in the middle of the night, it's because you dreamt of 2 power k. Okay, that's the worst thing that can happen to you. Okay, if 2 power k, if your program starts doing 2 power k order of magnitude fast, you know, I mean, so if it takes with respect to size k of the input, it takes 2 power k time, that's no good. Okay, and in this particular case, subsets are 2 power 5, so there are 32 classes of planning problems that we can solve. Okay, or you can just say, forget about all the subsets, I'll just solve the entire planning problem, which is removing all these assumptions and considering all those together. Okay. So there is also work, for example, you know, removing stochastic and partially observable together. Okay, and those are basically different types of planning problems. So stochastic and durative actions together. Okay, so what I was trying to say in this case is, I'll only talk about this, but there's a lot out there about how to extend some of this to those kinds of planning problems. And I have basically said nothing about a planning algorithm which has links from all of them. That's because we don't have a very smart idea. If in fact your world is dynamic, stochastic, partially observable, durative, continuous, live is my best answer. Okay, we don't really know how to do efficient planning. You know, get a really shiny coin, toss it, and see what the action is and do it. It's not as bad as that is, as bad as that. In fact, one of the things you could do if you really are stuck with a really, really bad world which has all those properties. One idea you could do is the following. Suppose, let's do this. Suppose all I know is suppose I figure out, by the end of this class, you figure out how to do this problem, okay? And you walk out and you get stuck in a planning problem which requires durative action. And you need to decide what action to do next. Would you bring out your shiny coin right away to say, I don't know anything about this world, so I'll just toss it? Or should you do something slightly more smarter? Obviously, since I said smarter, you would have to go with smarter. I mean, but so, you know, it's a loaded question. One idea is, well, durative actions, ignore the duration. Everything else, keep it. Just act as if all the actions are instantaneous. Okay? Try to figure out what's the best plan modulo that one assumption. Okay? So I relax this constraint, the durative action constraint, and I will get a relaxed problem. The relaxed problem is the classical planning problem. I solve the classical planning problem. If I solve the relaxed problem and I get a solution, what does that do for us, for the real problem? Have you heard of relaxed problems? Why do we solve relaxed problems? Because we are lazy, but also because they're very useful in making heuristics. Okay, so what I really want to do is, I have a place like this, and I'm here, I need to get here. This is my start state, this is my goal state. And I want to find the shortest path for this. And, well, you know, you could do nice Voronoi sort of diagrams or full search and figure out, well, that's the path. Or you could wish away all the obstacles, ignore obstacles. If you ignore obstacles, then the shortest path between this and this is a straight line distance. That's a relaxed problem. If you relax the obstacles, you can solve the problem easily because on the plane, the shortest distance between 2 points is a straight line. You take that, and if you have nothing else to do, so if you are sitting here and you have no clue which direction you should proceed to go to goal here, you have no clue at all, rather than bring out your shiny coin, I would suggest that you at least figure out what is the crow flight straight line direction and start making progress that way. Okay, I mean, shiny coins should be used only when you have looked at everything else. Okay, so even though we have not figured out how to deal with the planning problem in all its gory details, everything, every piece that we have figured out is a relaxation. Okay, so suppose I have a stochastic, partially observable problem. I have two different relaxations to it. In fact, three different relaxations. Just ignore stochastic, keep partially observable. That's one type of planning problem. Ignore partial observability, keep stochastic. That's another type of relaxation. Ignore both of them and just do classical planning, a third type of relaxation. Of these relaxations, you would think classical planning would be too much of a relaxation. Okay? So the heuristic based on that is not likely to tell you what would be a good choice in the real problem. Okay? So one idea which I did not actually think of when I made this slide, and I thought it does make sense, is the progress you make on the simpler problems are not wasted because they wind up helping you heuristically in solving the larger problems. Okay, at least they'll stop you from using the shiny coin and deciding a random action. Okay, so that's about planning. One thing before I go into a specific planning problem called deterministic planning problem and talk about algorithms today, one thing that I want to discuss is two words, planning and scheduling. How many of you have heard them together, planning and scheduling? Okay, that's interesting. In fact, one of the interesting things is in most cases when somebody says, oh, we just planned something, they actually are talking about scheduling, it turns out. Okay, so for example, in a semiconductor manufacturing scenario, okay, they have a bunch of jobs. Early in the morning, the foreman or forewoman or foreperson has a bunch of jobs that they have to do by the end of the day. And they have these multi-billion dollar machines sitting there. Nothing should be idling too much because that's a lot of good money wasted, right? So what they're trying to figure out is what's the best way to allocate jobs to machines. Okay, they call that planning, but really it's scheduling. Okay, so the idea, you don't know that it's scheduling, but the distinction I'm trying to make is that problem where somebody has already decided what actions you must do, and all you, the programmer, all you, the agent is trying to do is figuring out what resources should be allocated to these actions. The resources can be temporal, such as when should they be started, when should they be ended. Could be machine-oriented, such as which machine should this widget be made on. There's a costly machine, there's a cheaper machine, which one would you make this on? Okay? That generally is the scheduling problem. Okay? Planning, you can think of it as a superset, but one important difference is in the planning, nobody tells you what actions you are supposed to do either. All they tell you is what goals you are supposed to achieve. Okay, so in the semiconductor manufacturing example, it's like telling the foreperson that, oh, by the end of the evening today, we want to make next generation computers, which is what Intel is stuck with. Okay, but that would mean essentially figuring out what sort of circuits to design, what sort of, you know, fabrication to make. Okay, not just somebody else designs the circuit, all you need to do is put it onto the various machines. Okay, these two problems are very well connected. In one case, you are doing both action selection and action sequencing. If you want to think about it in the simplest way, think of this as action selection. And this one is just sequencing, deciding what order to do the actions, deciding the time point at which the action should be started, deciding what resources should the actions be given. In terms of complexity-wise, this problem is harder or easier than that? What do you think? It has to be harder because it's a superset. Okay. In particular, most scheduling problems are only NP-complete, which is what makes AI special, because the only class where somebody will say only NP-complete is an AI class. Okay. Every other place, if they NP-complete, they'll look crestfallen and they'll say, my God, this is NP-complete, we have to run out of the room. In AI, simplest problems are NP-complete. And that's where the fun starts. Okay, scheduling is only NP-complete. Okay, whereas planning is P-space complete, which is what? Another way of thinking about NP-completeness, if you haven't done theory courses, is if somebody gives you a solution and says it's a solution, you should be able to check whether it's a solution or not in polynomial time. So if the solution came and bit you, you know, somewhere in the night, you should be able to see whether it's a solution or not in polynomial time. Okay? Then you are in the class NP, and the hardest problems in class NP are NP-complete problems. Okay? P-space complete is, even if the solution comes and bites you, it's the right solution. You will take more than polynomial time to figure out that it's actually a solution. Okay, and that basically means that for a given input, the solution could be exponentially large in the input parameter. Do you know of any problems where the solution for the problem is exponentially large in terms of input parameters? Towers of Hanoi, how many know? Towers of Hanoi, Towers of Babylon, Towers of Brahma, Towers of whatever. You know, they all the three names, five different. Towers of Hanoi is a classic problem where, you know, if you can do two towers, you shouldn't just start thinking I can do seven towers easily, because it's going to be exponentially larger, costlier. Not just costly, exponentially longer solution. Okay? And Tower of Hanoi problem can be seen as a simple planning problem. And so, in fact, you have a case where the solution is actually non-polynomially, I mean, it, the solution is longer than polynomial in terms of input parameters. So that's one way of thinking about why planning is actually harder. Okay. So we won't talk too much about this thing. Did you guys do CSPs? Constraint satisfaction problems? Okay, so if you did do CSPs, the best way to do scheduling is to convert scheduling problems into CSP problems. Okay, it's basically CSP. You did propositional satisfiability, right? You did propositional logic, right? You know satisfiability problem. Satisfiability problem is a CSP problem. And that can be complete. Okay, and you can convert a scheduling problem into, most scheduling problems into satisfiability problems. So that's an easy way to solve it. You cannot convert planning problems into satisfiability problems unless you put extra restriction. Okay. So that's about planning versus scheduling. So that's the higher level picture of what are the planning problems that are out there and why we want to do the easiest one, because the rest are even harder, and what is scheduling with respect to planning problems. Now let's do a little bit more detailed view. Let's take the simplest planning problem that I call the classical planning problem, okay? And that would be the deterministic planning, I'll call it. Given an initial state I and a goal state G and a set of actions, find your problem is to find a sequence of actions that when done from the initial state will take you to the goal state G. That's planning. That's it. Okay? So just so you'll see some connection to some sort of a toy domain. Here is a toy domain. Okay? There seem to be a crane and a thing onto which it's putting the stuff, and then that's now putting it onto the trucks, and these trucks, presumably your goals in this kind of a domain might be that there are a bunch of widgets which need to go from location one to location two. And so you need to decide to put them onto the trucks and then drive the trucks and then drop them off in another place. Okay. Another example that we'll look at in a few minutes is blocks world, where you have a bunch of blocks in some configuration on the table and you want to go from one configuration to another configuration, with the only actions being unstacking blocks, stacking them on top of each other, and things like that. Okay. So if you have this kind of a scenario, you know, basically planning problem would be, suppose this is my initial state, this is my goal state, tell me the sequence of actions that I should do to go from this initial state to goal state. That's it. This should be quite boring by now, because this looks like graph search, right? I mean, if you ignore the colors and the shapes inside, these are vertices, these are edges, and that's a graph. And so if you can find paths in a graph between vertices, then you should be able to do planning. That's it, right? And I could be done very fast and go home. If it was a full course, I'm done really fast. And if it's even a couple of lectures, I should be done fast, okay? Because we do know that Dijkstra's algorithm does this stuff in n log n time. You know, you can find a shortest path between two points in n log n time, where n is what? The number of vertices in the graph. This looks like a good idea, n log n, you know, it's just sorting. The problem, of course, is for any reasonable planning domain, the n that we are looking at is more like power 100, 10 power 100. N is 10 power 100, okay? Now, you might be wondering, you know, really? Can you have 10 power 100? Here is the same example, right? I'll just generalize it a slightly more. It won't make it any less toy problem than it was before. Okay. All I will do now is I have 5 locations, 3 robot carts, 100 containers, and 3 piles. That's it. And you can do some simple calculation. Doesn't require more than high school algebra to figure out that you have about 10 power 277 vertices in the graph that you were to write. If you were to write for that kind of a domain, if you were to write this kind of a graph, it would be 10 power 277 nodes. You know, would require a really large slide. And clearly, n log n, where n is 10 power 277, doesn't have the kind of sheen it had when n is equal to 7 or 20. Okay. Now, sort of nice, and we keep forgetting this, to kind of compare these numbers, the number of particles in the universe is only about 10 power 87. So we are talking a little more edge, you know, vertices than there are particles on the world. This should not be surprising to you, right? I mean, you are in the right class. I mean, you're in the wrong class if you're surprised by these kinds of numbers. You know, in the very beginning of this class, you probably heard about all sorts of atrociously large numbers. And that's why, you know, you actually have to worry about how to do search efficiently. Okay, so my argument till now here is, well, you know, just because Dijkstra lived, that doesn't mean we can't do anything useful, because his algorithm is useless if you were to do it right, you know, completely on this explicit graph. Okay, you somehow want to get down faster without having to look at the entire state space. Okay. Have you looked at that kind of problems? Have you looked at anything more than Dijkstra's algorithm in this course? What? None of them would do better than Dijkstra, but there is something else you did, which is actually somewhere on that slide, unfortunately. I was supposed to remove it. A-star, right? And A-star says if you got a rich uncle, which is your heuristic, then you can do much better than the size of the search space. Okay? So remember, just to, you know, just so that you will be sufficiently impressed again with A-star, if your branching factor is B, depth is d, your search tree is b power d size, okay? Any blind search is going to do, so b power d is the search space size, remember? When you say search space size, it looks menacing. But if I just say number of vertices in the graph, that somehow looks more comforting. But number of vertices is b power d, that's why we got stuck with this. Okay, and so you want to not do work which is of the order of this, and A star search says if you have a really rich uncle, you can do work of the order of what? This was a midterm quiz, actually. I think Juan Lu forgot to mention this. What? No. All I'm talking about is, if I didn't have a rich uncle, a good heuristic, I would have to do b power d amount of search. If I do have a really, really good heuristic, what's the amount of search I need to do? What? Of d. It's huge, huge savings. Huge savings. Okay? You'll never be this lucky. Okay? Let's get it straight. You'll never be this lucky. If in fact you could do it this way, then somebody already published a polynomial time algorithm for your problem, and that's why you could do it. Okay. Most of the time, you would sort of try to be in between b power d and d, but closer to this than this, or at least as far away from that as possible. So that's what search tries to do, and hey, that's a good thing. We could do A star search. So again, I'm done. Okay. So, you know, there is a lot of nice, way of being lazy is good in science, right? Because you don't want to reinvent problems. You know, if the problem that you're seeing in front of you can be reduced to some problem that you already figured out before, it's good. Don't be overeager and try to resolve every problem, you know, as if this is the first thing that you ever looked at, okay? So, you know A star search, shouldn't you be done? Well, we have one more trick up our sleeve. In fact, it is true that if you have A star search, you can do better than Dijkstra's algorithm. So, in fact, the discussion on planning is different from the discussion on search in as much as we actually have structured, we assume more structure to the state as well as the action. In a normal search algorithm, the only thing that you know about the problem is what? Child generation function and termination function, which are black box pieces of code that somebody can give you. Okay, and you are, if you write a good A-star search algorithm, it should be able to take as inputs functions. Child generate function, which takes a node and gives a bunch of nodes out, and a terminate function, which takes a node and says true or false. That's it. And every search algorithm that you have ever learned about, A-star, iterative deepening, breadth first, depth first, anything, SMC star, all that stuff, SMS star and all those, can still be written without knowing who are the children and am I done. The search algorithm doesn't take any of those things into account. So much of what we'll be doing in looking at planning as a search problem is actually to look at, do we know more about child generation function? Do we know more about when can we terminate? And if we do, can we somehow fold that into the search such that you could do much better, you can show much better performance than having a black box child generator function and a black box goal test function, a termination test function. Okay, this is not going to be, this is not one of those things that will be right as soon as I said it, it would not be obvious to you. But hopefully by the end of these lectures, you should be able to go back to this and say, is that true? Did we actually use the the advantages of having structure for the state? Okay, let me give you, so the specific structure we have is the following. We just say that all states are made up of state variables, and a state is determined uniquely in terms of the values those state variables take. Okay, and I'll give you an example in a minute. And then furthermore, when an action is done, you define the action in terms of what it does to the state variables rather than to the states. Okay, so let me give you an example. So the state, so what we'll be looking at are these things called state variable models. The idea is world is made up of states which are defined in terms of state variables. For now, let's assume that these state variables are all Boolean. Okay, so if there are k Boolean state variables that can define your domain, right, then how many states are there? 2 to the k. Yeah, you're learning. Good, yeah. So 2 to the k. So if there are k state variables, then there are 2 power k states in the domain. So you are able to, rather than think in terms of all 2 power k states, you're just thinking in terms of k state variables and their true false values. That's what you're doing, okay? And then a state is really a complete assignment over the state variables. That's how you got 2 power k, okay? Actions change the values of the state variables directly. So they doctor the state variables. So for example, if I have 2 state variables, A, which can be true or false, B, which can be true or false, and I do an action A1, it might then say, well, after me, if this is true here and false here, the action might say, after this action is done, A will become false, and B will remain what it is. I'll look at more examples. But essentially, actions are changing. They're doctoring the insights of the state. Now, what is the opposite? What is the other option? As against what? As against actions telling you in the example graph that we looked at previously, in this kind of graph, what are the actions telling you? An action basically tells you, if you do me in state S1, I will take you to state S7. If you do me in S5, I'll take you to S9. If you do me in S9, I'll take you to S11. So previously, action representation is written this way. Okay, the simplest way to write that kind of an action representation is as an incidence matrix of the following form, S1 to Sn, okay, and then here S1 to Sn, and so it's a S by S matrix. All actions would be S by S matrices. And this matrix will have zeros and ones. And the one here essentially says that if you do this action in Sk, if you do this action in Sj, you will get Sk. If you do this action in Sj, you'll get Sk. That's what that one says. Okay? Now, having said that, so the old way of representing actions, which I did not go into too much detail, is actions were incidence matrices, which is S by S matrix. The new way would be actions will directly be described in terms of what they do to the state variables. Okay. But one thing, before I go into the continuation of this line, I want to ask you a different question. If I have, just to see whether we are still awake, if I have, in this kind of representation, are all actions going to have the same sized representation, or are they going to have different sized representations? All actions would be represented as the same F by F matrix. All that matters, all that changes is where are the ones and where are the zeros. Okay, all actions would have the same size matrix. So all of them have the same size representation. So an action which only does a little teensy beansy change to one of the 10,000 state variables would have the same size representation as the action which just does havoc to every possible state variable. All of them are equal sized. Now you could think of this as, wow, great uniformity, or you could think of this as, my God, reduction to least common denominator. You know, all actions are being represented in the worst possible way. Okay. Second issue. What if I give you this kind of a matrix and say this represents an action? Can you tell by looking at this, can I have written a, write a program which looks at this matrix and tells you whether the action is deterministic or not? Just a matrix, right? What makes this action deterministic is if I wind up putting one more one here, that means if I do action A in Sj, I could get into either this state or this state. Those are two different states. It's not deterministic anymore. If I only have one one per column, then it's deterministic. If I have more than one one per column, then it's non-deterministic. This is interesting because it's a simple representation, and you can connect up what you know about stochastic non-deterministic actions in terms of what happens here in the ground level. So you should be able to write this kind of representations for actions. Now, what happens if you have stochastic actions? If you have stochastic actions instead of zeros and ones, you have zeros and real numbers between 0 and 1. Okay? And a column should add up to 1. Okay? Each column should add up to 1. That's it. So there's a beauty to this representation. It's a dumb idea. This is like, remember this? You remember that? What is that? That's the definition of derivative. How many of you actually do derivatives? Of course, you're computer science students, you never do derivatives. You've forgotten all of that. But if you, the time when you used to do derivatives, how many of you ever did use this first principles way? You don't. You know, in fact, much of progress is to find shortcuts, find macros. Okay? So most of the time, if you are given x power 7, you don't try to plug that into that. You do your little formula, which says nx for n minus 1, and then you're done. Okay? However, it's important to know this, because this is the first principles idea of what differentiation is. It's a limit defined that way. And it's similarly important to understand that If you don't have factored representations and all this extra syntactic sugaring, an action really is an incident matrix. Okay, state by which whose size is S by S. And that matrix normally has zeros and numbers. The numbers can be ones, and if there's only one, at most one one per column, then it's a deterministic action. If not, it's a stochastic action. It's a non-deterministic action. And if it's a stochastic action, then the numbers in a column should sum up to one. Okay. And I said this on the board, but there are slides here that you can go back and read. Okay. And they say exactly the same thing that I said on the board. Okay. Now, so actions change the values of the state variables. Now we go back to the state variable model where states are in terms of state variables and actions change the state variables directly. Here is an example, finally, a simple Dwarfs-World example where I have the following actions. I mean the following state variables. The state variables are of the type onTable X, onXY, clearX, handEmpty, holdingX. Where each variable, this is actually the schema. So in fact, if you have three blocks named A, B, and C, right, in your domain, if you have three blocks named A, B, and C, then in essence, you have onTable A, onTable B, onTable C, which are three Boolean state variables. On A, B, on B, A, on A, A, on B, B, on C, C, on C, B, you get the drift. Those are all the on state variables, and then the clear A, clear B, clear C are the clear state variables. Hand empty is just hand empty, it has no arguments. And holding A, holding B, holding C are the state variables for holding, after holding time. Okay? And then the initial state, of course, is a complete specification of truth and false values to all the state variables. And of course, since you are giving a complete state, and it's a Boolean domain, you can by convention only name the ones that are true and ignore all the ones that are false. So if you didn't mention something, it's false. This can only be done if it's a complete description, right? If it's incomplete description, then if something is missing, that could be because you didn't know anything about it, or because it's actually false and that's why you didn't mention it. Okay? So for complete descriptions, normally variables with false values are omitted from the description. But from your point of view, you should just think of them as each variable has its true or false value given completely. A goal state is, so for example, here is a problem. In the initial state, A is on table, B is on table, A is clear, B is clear, hand empty. Okay? So presumably, you visualize the situation. I don't have to draw good blocks to tell you how this thing looks. Now, a goal state is a partial specification of the desired variable value combination. A goal state doesn't have to be a complete state. It can be any one of the many states which are equally good for you. Okay? So if all you really care about, for example, in this problem, I only care that B is not clear and hand is empty. That's all I care about. That's my problem. I don't care about A. I don't care what happens to it. All I care is B is not clear and hand is empty. Neither do I care about what happens to holding A and holding B. Myself, I don't care. Okay, it may well be that when you try to make these true, certain things will be forced into certain values. But if they're not, then any value they take is fine with me. Okay? So normally, if there are k state variables and you give only values to m of them, okay, then it, so partial state only gives values to m of them, so it really corresponds to 2 power some number of complete states. What number of complete states? K minus m complete states. So everything that's not been mentioned, it can be either false or true. And k minus m number of things were not mentioned in the goal state. So you really are saying, I'm easy to please. You know, you can give me any of these 2 power k minus m states, I would be happy. Okay? So this is good stuff.
having a partial state for goal is a good stuff. Is it equally good to have a partial state for initial state? So I just argued that having a goal state, which is a partial state, that means it doesn't require, it doesn't even name all the state variables. It only names some of the variables that it cares about. That seems like a flexible thing on your boss's part. He says, you really don't care, you know, all I need you to do is 80 hours of work per week. You know, you could have as much fun as you want. You know, so that's the nice partial, you know, state specification, you know. So boss is being very flexible. Right? I mean, he's not saying, she's not saying, you must have a red tie every day, and all that stuff. So at least some things are being given away. So my question is, can I have partial state description also for the initial state? If you have partial state for the initial state, things go bad. Things go bad because, in essence, so if you only name K, I mean, if you only name M of the K state variables, right, that means you really think you are anywhere in 2 power K minus M state. When M equal to K, you know the exact state you are in because that's 2 power 0, 1. When M equal to 0, that's complete ignorance. I have no clue where I am. I could be in any one of the 2 power K states. No, this is the initial state.
Right, but
oh my God. Argue this out. That's a good question.
If the goal state is unspecified, then any of the...
I did not say goal state is unspecified.
Okay, but just for comparison, when the goal state was unspecified above, when it had, you know, n unspecified variables, then any of them that met the k requirement were valid. So why is it different for initial state?
So basically, you are winning $1 billion is a possibility when you go to Las Vegas, right? When you go to Las Vegas, I mean, you have to keep changing gear. This is the way I keep you awake. So when you go to Las Vegas, you know, one possibility when you play one of these crazy games is that you could win $1 billion. Presumably, you would want to win $1 billion. That's your goal. So you're done. You can come home. Actually, you would be rational if you don't play, right? But the point is, the fact that it is possible doesn't mean you have a plan of winning it. Because if you have, in the beginning, up front, when you're standing in front of this guy who is dealing the cards or throwing the dice, every one of them are equally possible. In fact, your losing is more possible than your winning.
Right, but if you didn't specify how much I had already won, then let's say my initial state was I had already won $1 million. I could have just landed the initial state on the goal state and said, I'm done.
Okay, so here's the question. So That's a good point. So, let's see, how do I do this? There is a colorful problem called robot kidnapping problem. A kidnap robot, and you know, hopefully Tempe police won't catch you for this. A kidnap robot problem is one of the hard problems in robotics. The idea is, the robot is walking around and then you just close its eyes and throw it somewhere. Right? And then it needs to localize itself. What it's supposed to be doing, you know, there are museum guide robots, which are supposed to show little kids, you know, all the places in the museum. And you kidnap the museum guide robot, and then you put it in some, you know, some storeroom, right? Now, at the time, and, you know, and of course you also poke its eyes, let's say, so that it can't actually tell where it is. So now when it opens, it's in one of many possible places, including the museum. You know, and so it can start talking and what?
It doesn't get to choose where it's placed.
Exactly. No, but that's the point. When the initial state is, when one says that initial state can be one of K states, you don't have the choice. That means it could be any one of those K states.
But, yeah, but
that's the definition.
It's not, there are M possible states, you can choose wherever you want.
No, you don't get to choose your initial state. Anyway, so we'll talk more about this offline, okay? So presumably, I think it should be clear hopefully to most of you that you don't get to choose your initial state. Them are the cards you're dealt with, and you deal with if you don't know which of the many states you are in and you still want to succeed, you better have a plan that succeeds irrespective of what your current state is. Okay, so let's talk about bomb in the toilet. That's another important problem in AI, called bomb in the toilet, which is so you go to a toilet, presumably, and you find that there are two shiny packages, completely indistinguishable. They both are actually equally shiny. All you know is that one of those packages has a bomb in it. Okay, and it's going to go off, and you know, you went in, the door is closed, it's going to go off. Okay, and you don't presumably want to die, right? And the only action you have is the following action, which says, if you were to dunk a package, and if it were to have a bomb, I mean, if you dunk and flush the toilet, one of those industrial strength toilets, and you dunk it and you flush it, right? And if it did have a bomb before, then the bomb has been neutralized after the flushing. That's the only action you have. That's the only action you have. So you don't know which package has the bomb. The actions will tell you if you know which package has the bomb, and if you were to flush it, it won't be there anymore. There won't be a bomb. Would you live or not live in this scenario? What are you supposed to do? So this guy will live. The rest of you would be thinking, what should I do? And you're dead. Okay. So that's a classic plan called a conformant plan. I don't care what the state I am in. I will do the actions. After my actions, I will know the goal state. There's a classic children's poem which goes, I think, by Sandra Boynton, which goes, something about all these animals were sleeping in the jungle, and then the elephant, you know, yells. So some are sleeping, some are not, and the elephant wakes up and yells at the top of its voice. And all we know is whoever was sleeping or not sleeping, after this, they're all awake. Okay? And, you know, one can make an argument that that's how we dealt with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We didn't know whether they had it or not. But the heck with it. We're not going to figure out whether they have it or not. Let's go and level the place to some extent. Then they won't have it, right? So we had a conformant plan. We had a conformant plan for the war, which basically, now it's clear that they don't have any weapons of mass destruction. Before, it could be yes, it could be no, you know. So in a sense, what I'm saying is, when you have multiple possible initial states, and you still have a single goal that you want to achieve, you better have a plan that works irrespective of what your initial state is. The plan that I gave you is a conformant plan, which doesn't sense. So in fact, people also call it a nonsense plan. That means no sensing. Okay? Another version of solving these problems is have a sensing action, which would actually check, you know, do some tests and figure out what's the likelihood that in fact this package has the bomb versus this package has the bomb. And based on the test, you would go this direction in the plan or this direction in the plan. That's like asking this, you know, that UN guys to go around slowly looking to see whether or not there are WMDs in Iraq. That's a sensing plan, and this is non-sensing plan. Okay. So either way, the planning problem changes once the initial state is partial state. Whereas goal state being partial state is good because that's being flexible. Okay. So then there is pick up, and then here are the actions now. Okay. The actions are pick up, stack, put down, unstack. Those are the only ones I have. And the description I have of these actions are that here pickup can be done in any state in which the state variable hand empty is true, state variable clear x is true, state variable on table is true. That means it has the value true. Okay? And after that, the new state, it will make sure that in the new state, holding x will have the value true, on table x will have the value false, hand empty will have the value false, clear x will have the value false. So one way of doing pickup x to a state is first check whether in that state these state variables have the values they're supposed to have. If so, then you can do this action. When you do the action to compute the new state, you copy over the old state and overwrite these state variables to make sure that they have the values that this guy requires them to have. Because after this action, these are the values they will have. The rest of the state variables, which are not mentioned in the FX, remain having the values that they had before the action was done. Okay? If you want to see an example, so here, on table A, on table B, clear A, clear B, hand empty is my state. If I were to do pickup A, to be able to do pickup A, first of all, it must be the case that what? Holding A must be, to be able to pick up A, hand empty must be true. Is hand empty true? Yes. On table A must be true. Is on table A true? Yes. So you can do this action now. Now what I can do is to compute the new state, I will copy over the old state. It was in black originally. And then I changed only those variables which were mentioned in the effect of the pickup A to have the values the effect say they must have. So for example, after pickup A, holding A must be true. What was holding A here? False. That's why we didn't mention it. Now it becomes true. Okay? And clear A becomes false. Previously clear A was true, it becomes false. Because after you pick up A, this is not me telling you physics of Bloch's world. This is me just blindly copying what pickup X says. Pickup X says after pickup X, holding X would be true, not on table X would be true, not hand empty would be true, not clear X would be true. This is the description of the domain. This is given as the input to the planner. And you know, all you do is just making sure that this is holding A is true, not clear A is true, not hand on table A is true, not hand empty is true. Now here's the question. This was a complete state. This was simple problems, right? Deterministic planning problems, the initial state is complete. I did an action. Do I still have a complete state? Yes. So in fact, what I can do is now having made this, I can remove hand empty, on table, clear, because they're negative, I mean they're false, and by convention we don't mention anything that's false, just to keep the state looking small. So in fact, in a textbook maybe, it can so happen that they will say, this is the state before, and the state after is just on table B and clear B. That's because everything else is now false. In fact, all states have exactly the same size, which is equal to the number of state variables. It's because you want to just talk about, you know, by convention only mention the positive ones. Sometimes they can be smaller versus larger. There's nothing whatsoever wrong with false. I want you to understand this. Okay? It's okay to have negative goals. Okay? It's okay to have a goal saying not destroy the world. That's a very good goal. Okay? Right? So, in fact, there is no value judgment in negative versus positive. They're just variable values. It's a Boolean variable, it has true and false, you know. And you could have, if you liked it the other way around, you could have, you know, kept all the false ones and say, by definition, all the true ones, all the ones that are not mentioned are true. The reason I mention this is in many planning, in the descriptions of, you know, elementary planning algorithms, you might wind up seeing that somehow it's important that the actions have only positive preconditions and that goals must only be positive. That's not needed. In fact, it's just a variable and a value. Okay. So these are the actions and that's the problem. Do you have a solution for that problem? It's a Bloch's world problem. All I want is B should not be clear, hand should be empty. And A and B are on table and hand was empty originally. How would the world look like if you achieve this world? I mean, first of all, can you achieve this world using these actions from that state? Late in the evening. What? Yes? Okay, what is the plan? Tell me the plan. Plan is a sequence of actions. tell me the sequence of actions you should do from the initial state such that after that the goal would be true. It's a simple problem, right? You guys were all tickling when I said the blocks world. Blocks world. We did it as kids. So all you need to do is what? Pick up A and stack it on B. Interesting. It's kind of a sort of indirect solution. That's why you didn't get it right away. If I said on A, B as the goal, everybody knows. Okay. But sometimes, because I gave you the partial state and I only said, get me not clear B and hand empty, it wasn't clear to you as to what must be the action. Okay, I made it sound as if having a partial goal state is a good thing, right? Right? Suppose I told you that the complete goal I want is not clear B, hand empty, A on top of B. It's the same problem as this one. But it'll be much easier to do. Because on AB will right away tell you, the reason on AB, to make on AB true, A should be on top of B. And then everything else falls into place. So removing some of the goals that you need to achieve is actually, I made it sound as if it's a flexible thing. It's somebody being nice to you. But it could also be bad to you. It's a cruel joke your boss was playing on you, saying, we have very few restrictions around here. All we need is just 80 hours of work and a formal dress, and which basically means red tie most of the time, and not having any fun in your life. They didn't say that, but having, by the time you figured it all out, that's what you signed up for, So in this case, that's the plan for that. Okay, so we want to make these kinds of plans. Two simple algorithms that I'll quickly discuss, and then we'll come back to them more in detail next time. One is basically what I want to do is convert this into a search algorithm. Okay? And so to do this into a search algorithm, what do I need to do? I need a child generator function and a goal test function. That's all. Okay? The most obvious way to do child generator is take the state, look at your library of actions. Consider all the actions that are applicable in the state. For each action that's applicable, compute the new state. Sort of you're going in the forward direction. Okay, so here, for example, you have this, and you consider all the actions, I guess at least these actions are applicable, and these are the states. And all the new states, you throw them onto the queue, search queue, and let your search algorithm deal with it. How do you know when you're done? That's a goal test. When can you stop? If you ever pick up a state and you're about to expand that state, before you expand, you do the termination test. And what's the termination test? All you need to do is to see if the current state is consistent with what is required in the goal state. So goal state says these five variables, these three variables should be true, these two variables should be false. If this state actually satisfies those five variables values, then it's a goal state. It doesn't matter what the rest of the variables are saying. So it's very simple to check whether or not it's a goal state. Okay? So if you do this, you call this progression planning. It's basically just forward search. You're searching in the forward direction by applying actions to the state. Simple. Okay? So a generic progression planner goal test, check if every state variable in S that is mentioned in the goal G has the value that the G gives, that the goal state gives it. A goal state requires it to have. And the child generator is for each action, small a in the set of all actions, if every variable mentioned in the preconditions of the small a has the same value in it as well as in the state S. That means that whatever the precondition is saying, if it says precondition says this state variable must be true, and if the state has that variable to be true, then one tick for it. And all preconditions must be satisfied that way. And if that is the case, then return the progressed state, where progressed state is generated by copying over the old state, overwriting only the state variables which are mentioned in the FX. Almost lobotomy of states. internals of the state. Okay, that's it. That's your power search. And you search, start from the initial state, and you do this. You have converted the so-called structured representation into a normal search. Now, just because you did this, it's not really going to make the search much faster. You still have to figure out how to do heuristics for this, which would be the bulk of next class. But before you run away, I want to mention one other thing, which is something that you wouldn't have thought about, and at least I should give you something that you wouldn't have thought about from the point of view of doing planning a search. If I, all I give you is a child generator, it has the direction it has. You know, child generator takes the state and gives you the new state. So you, in a sense, only go in the direction that the child generator function will take you, which is normally forward. Now, my child generator function was made up from the descriptions of the action, which are in terms of state variables, in terms of preconditions and effects. Why can't I do them in the backward direction? Why can't I start from the goal state? Why can't I start from the goal state, apply actions in the backward direction until I reach the initial state? Why not? In a normal graph, it's no big deal, right? In a graph, you know, I used to have a graph there, and there was an S node, there's a G node. It doesn't matter whether S was the initial node and G was the goal node, or G was the initial node, S was the goal node. You just find a path between them, you know. But in planning, actually, they have asymmetry. The goal and the initial state have asymmetry, right? What's the asymmetry? Goals are actually partial states. Initial states are complete states. Okay. Furthermore, in fact, you want to be able to figure out what does it mean to apply an action in the backward direction. Okay. There is a big description which I won't go into today, thankfully, but I want to at least make you understand what I'm doing here in terms of generating these branches. Okay. I can apply an action in the backward direction as long as at the minimum its effects are not inconsistent with the state into which it's being applied. So suppose this put down A says, if this action were to say clear B would be true after this action, it cannot be the last action that would come before this state, can it? Because this guy is saying clear B should be true, this guy is saying clear B should be false. That's not possible. So you can only put an action in the backward direction if its effects are consistent with your goals. That means they're not killing anybody. Okay? So the minimum thing, as they say to the doctors, is first do no harm. First do no harm. So action must not do any harm to any of the goals. And having not done any harm, to actually make your doctor peace, you have to do something useful. Okay? So in this case, it's not just enough that this action isn't killing any goal that is needed. For it to be really part of the plan, it better be giving at least one thing that is needed. Do you understand what I'm saying? It should be at least giving one thing that is needed. So you'll notice that there is no variable V such that V is given different values by effects of A and state S. That's the consistency requirement. And there is at least one variable V dash such that V dash is given the same value by the effects of this action and the state in which you are regressing. That's being useful. If you must give up on one of these and still be a sound planner, which would you rather give up on? Second, because you would get really stuck with huge insurance if you start killing patients. Okay. And if they don't get well, oftentimes they don't understand why they didn't get well. But if they die, they kind of figure out, at least their relatives do. So inconsistency should never happen. Okay? And if you can, I mean, if you should, at least you should be consistent, and if possible, at least also be useful. So those are the two conditions. Whenever an action satisfies those, then I can regress this state over this action. When I regress this state over this action, again I do this algebraic copying. What I do is I copy everything in this state to here, except those things that are already given by put down A. So now when you do put down A, what happens? Hand empty would be an effect of put down A, right? If you put down anything, your hand would be empty. So hand empty does not have to be copied over. But put down A does not give not clear B. So you would have to copy over not clear B. So that much I have done. That's one part of copying over operation. The second part is, the assumption is that now whatever is this state, this action would be applied in this state to give you this state. Right? So it's not enough. So for you to get this state, it's better that not clear B is true here, because not clear B would then be true here too. And the hand empty would be given by this guy, so everybody is happy. Only problem is, this guy would not even get done unless his preconditions are actually true. Right? So copy over the entire precondition formula of put down A here. Copy over the entire precondition A and holding the precondition formula of the put down A here. So that's how I generated this state here. Because to put down A, the only thing that's required for put down A, and this is not my description of Locke's world, this is what we decided is Locke's world. Put down X, holding X is the only precondition. So I was just copying over, I was just looking at my action description, and according to that, all I needed to add was holding A. This part is for the preconditions of this, this part is the residual that this guy didn't satisfy. The rest of it this guy satisfied. The same way, stack AB would be tried here, because stack AB will give what useful thing does it give? What useful thing is stack AB giving? If you put A on top of B, not clear B is the thing that it's giving. So that's why it's useful. And it's not against hand empty. Because after stack AB, hand would be empty, and this guy requires hand empty. So the one thing it's giving, the other thing it's not against it. So I can do stack AB as the last action. And if I do the stack AB as the last action, then hand empty would then be, it's a stack AB. Actually, in fact, stack AB gives hand empty too. Because when you stack A on top of B, again, I'm not making up Locke's world. This is the things we wrote here. If you stack X on Y, then X would be on top of Y. Y won't be clear. X would not be held anymore, and hand would be empty. So in fact, when I do stack AB, both of these are true. And then both of them are given by this guy. So nothing from here needs to be copied here. So it almost looks as if you're done. Except, you need to be able to do this. To do stack AB, you have to copy over its preconditions. To do stack AB, you need holding A. You should be holding A so that you can put it on B. And it better be the case that B is clear. So you now work on B. Okay? So it's a nice idea. Think of these as goals. And you do this action, you get new sub-goals. You do some other action, you'll get some new sub-goals. You do some other action, you get new sub-goals. And you can keep going. When can you stop? I mean, you want to stop this class first, but when can you stop research? How do I decide that I reach the initial state? All I want to check is if my sub-goal state is already holding in the initial state. So suppose my initial state already has not clear B and holding A to be true in the initial state, then I can stop here. This is what you've been looking for. I got it in the initial state. You're grounded. Grounded in a good sense. Okay? So no more search required. So you get to go home. Okay? So the goal test condition really is stop when the state F dash is entailed by the initial state. What it means is, whatever the F dash requires is already true in the initial state. Which way of doing search is better? Going backward or going forward? So think about the following thing. You know, I wake up in the middle of the, in the morning, and the most important thing, you woke up, and the most important thing you are going to do today is to come to this class. Presumably the rest of your life doesn't matter. Okay. Now, if you started doing forward search, what can I do now that I'm sitting on my bed? Well, a huge number of things you can do.
Okay, you can stare at the wall, you can stare at the plant, you can stare at your feet, you know, you get the drift. And then after staring at the wall for a while, then you can stare at your feet, and you can do a whole bunch of things, huge amount of search, which doesn't get you anywhere close to this class. Okay, and which is after all the most important thing you're supposed to do today. The other possible way is, okay, I need to be at the class, which means I need to be at the university, which means I need to be in my car and get down at the university, which means I must be driving my car, which means all that stuff. Going backward, I made it sound beautiful. This is how you guys do planning. If you write a program, which one do you think works better? What happens, interestingly, this is, we'll continue this discussion tomorrow, I mean on Wednesday. What happens is, if you do blind search, you would like to think that forward search will have a much higher branching factor, huge branching factor. If there are extraneous actions in the domain, there are a huge number of extraneous actions, and you can do all of them and make your search tree really fat and not get anywhere. Okay? Whereas if you're going in the backward direction, only some things actually are giving anything required in the goal state. And so the branching factor becomes much smaller. The depth of the solution is the same. Whether you go forward or backward, the optimal plan has the same length. So this argument makes it sound as if, since B is smaller for regression and much bigger for progression, regression should win hands down. It does, if it's blind search. If you have a rich uncle, which is a heuristic, it doesn't really matter. People do search only when they don't have rich uncles. You know, people do search, only losers do search. Okay, winners get a good heuristic and apply it. And it turns out that when you actually use heuristics, and we'll talk about next class, a class of heuristics that are very useful, which all the state-of-the-art planners do, it turns out that regression planners are not as good as progression planners, actually. And figuring that out is just almost as interesting as being proven to be wrong, you know, in your intuition. So come back next time and we'll talk about it.